Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 18th, 2021. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from Coralville. Turning to the front page of today's Gazette, new law, public must know of plans to stop adding fluoride, by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Less than a century ago, it was unusual for a 30-year-old not to have dentures, according to Dr. Bob Russell, Iowa's public health dental director. A lot has changed in oral hygiene, but one of the most sweeping changes, and one that helps poor and wealthy people alike, is the fluoridation of drinking water. Boosting the natural fluoride in drinking water hardens the enamel on people's teeth and makes teeth less vulnerable to cavities. But an increasing number of communities, including cities in Iowa, have stopped adding fluoride to drinking water, possibly based on misinformation about how much fluoride people get from other sources. A new Iowa law that went into effect July 1st requires public water system operators to give residents at least a 90-day notice before they stop adding fluoride to drinking water. We had reports that communities had stopped fluoridation and had not informed their citizens or councils, Russell said. When residents discovered the change and wanted to return to fluoridation, their water supply systems were required to update to new state standards, which could be costly, Russell said. Our goal was we should alert our citizens these things are in debate and we should let them choose, he said. Starting in the 1930s, dentists observed people who drank water with naturally occurring fluoride seemed to have fewer cavities, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention reported. Scientists started researching fluoride, a mineral released from rocks, to try to find out if it could be safely added to water to protect people from tooth decay. In 1945, Grand Rapids, Michigan became the first U.S. city to add fluoride to drinking water. The move paid off when 5 years later, researchers learned that Grand Rapids children had significantly fewer cavities than did children from surrounding communities, the CDC reported. Other U.S. cities started adding low levels of fluoride to boost the natural levels to a standard set by the government. Iowa City has been fluoridating drinking water since the 1960s, now adding fluoride until the natural levels of about 0.25 milligrams per liter reach 0.7 milligrams per liter, said Craig Meacham, assistant water superintendent for the city of about 75,000. The city has flow-controlled pumps, so if the water flow reduces, the fluoride feed slows down. Water operators test the raw drinking water and finished drinking water for fluoride every day. The city also sends a monthly water sample to the State Hygienic Laboratory in Coralville so the local test can be verified for accuracy. Over the years, I've had a number of phone calls from customers who wanted to talk about fluoride and argue about fluoride, said Meacham, who has worked for the city's water department for 31 years. When I tell them it exists naturally and it's proven by science to help tooth decay and that we carefully monitor the feed and don't overdose, I think some people are reassured by that. If not, he tells them to go talk to your dentist. For every dollar spent on community water fluoridation, $38 is saved in dental treatment costs, the state public health department reported. Fluoride reduces cavities by at least 25% in both children and adults. And a growing body of evidence shows keeping teeth healthy improves overall health, Russell said. What we've been learning quite clearly is there is an interface between medical and dental disease that drives up cases of morbidity, Russell said. As teeth get infected, that can get into the bloodstream, into the heart, lungs, and many different systems. There are a variety of related conspiracy theories about fluoride, all revolving around the idea of governments, including the Nazi regime, putting fluoride in water supplies to control the population, according to a 2016 article in Vice. Some of these theories say large corporations are in on it, making profits based on keeping people docile. There is this resistance to fluoride in drinking water, and it's mostly unfounded, said David Swierthny, a University of Iowa engineering professor and director of the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination, which provides free testing for lead and other contaminants in school drinking water. There are legitimate questions about how much fluoride should be added to water. Fluorosis, a condition that can cause discolored teeth, can occur if people get too much fluoride, but severe cases of the illness are rare, and no evidence indicates that recommended levels of community water fluoridation lead to severe dental fluorosis, the U.S. National Institutes of Health reported. There also have been concerns about fluoride hurting children's bone growth, but a team of researchers led by Stephen Levy, a UI dentistry professor, found by tracking children from birth until age 25 that fluoride consumption did not affect their bone development. In 2015, the CDC updated its recommendation on fluoride levels from 1 to 2 milligrams per liter of water to 0.7 to 1.25 milligrams per liter in response to new information about fluoride available from other sources, including toothpaste and mouthwash. If science says we don't need as much, you want to reduce it, Russell said. It's a sign of transparency and honesty. About 20% of Iowa communities do not fluoridate water, Russell said. Since 2017, 15 Iowa communities totaling more than 25,000 residents have stopped adding fluoride to water, the state public health department reported. Ely, a Linn County city of 1650, ended decades of fluoridation in 2020 at the recommendation of the water treatment manager, Mayor L.D. Miller said. A report the manager provided to the city council before the vote says most homes use water filtration systems that remove fluoride. Reverse osmosis filtration systems do remove fluoride, the Gazette confirmed, but most water softening is done with ion exchange, which does not remove fluoride. The Ely report overstates the amount of fluoride in toothpaste and used as evidence a 2016 article in Harvard Public Health that was widely rebutted by dental and pediatric organizations, some of which asked for the article to be retracted. We have not received complaints from the citizens since it has been removed, Miller said. We did receive complaints beforehand that fluoride was being added. The city of Tama, which has about 2,700 residents, stopped fluoridating water earlier this year based on a decision by Water Superintendent Kent Campbell, the Tama Toledo News Chronicle reported. The city council decided April 5th to support Campbell's decision, but at a June meeting, several public health officials asked the council to reconsider. Mayor Doug Ray told the Gazette the council still is collecting data and may reconsider the decision. We haven't ruled it out by any means, he said. Also from the front page of today's Gazette, abortions rise even as laws aim to limit them, by Michaela Ram of the Gazette. Despite state lawmakers' efforts to curtail them, abortions in Iowa have been increasing after years of declines. For the second consecutive time, the number of medically and surgically induced abortions performed in the state has risen over the year before. Iowa saw 4,058 abortions performed in 2020, a 14% increase from the previous year, according to new data from the State Department of Public Health. In 2019, 3,566 abortions were performed, a 25% increase from the 2,849 procedures conducted in 2018, state data shows. For years leading up to 2019, the number of pregnancies terminated in the state had been dropping. The over 2,800 abortions performed in 2018 represented the lowest total reported since 2012, when 4,648 procedures were conducted in Iowa, according to state data. While the new data showed the number of abortions in 2020 was nearing the 2012 level, it still was well short of the 2006 level of 6,728 abortions in the state. Nationwide, the number of abortions fell by 19% between 2011 and 2017, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. At the same time, birth rates also have been declining statewide in recent years. The State Health Department reported 11.9 birth rate per 1,000 population, a drop from the rate of 13.2 in 2009. Those in favor of abortion rights say Iowa's rising abortion rate is a result of state policies that reduce access to contraceptives for women. The increases do come following a 2017 decision by the Iowa legislature to withdraw from a federally funded family planning program in favor of a state-run version that barred Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers. The year after it launched, the state's family planning program saw an 85% drop in use of services, which included those that provided birth control and information on how to prevent pregnancy, according to data from the Iowa Department of Public Health. Sally Peterson, a former Democratic lieutenant governor who served as executive director for the Iowa Initiative to Reduce Unintended Pregnancies, pointed to this policy as a driver of this trend. She said improving access to reliable contraception is a precursor to reducing abortions. When unintended pregnancies go up, abortions go up, Peterson said. Advocates opposed to abortion rights at the Family Leader, on the other hand, said circumstances of the pandemic rendered the 2020 tally virtually useless. Officials with the conservative organization also said it's harder to get accurate statistics with chemical and telemedicine abortions performed in Iowa. In the big picture, however, this is all the more reason that Iowa needs more reliable data and abortion reporting methods, said Drew Zahn, communications director for the Family Leader. In recent years, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and the Iowa legislature, also controlled by the Republican Party, have passed laws aimed at limiting abortions in Iowa. Earlier this year, lawmakers approved the first step in moving forward with a state constitutional amendment that would make clear the state does not recognize or grant the right to an abortion. If approved in the 2023 or 2024 legislative session, the measure would be put to a vote before Iowans in the 2024 general election. Other legislative efforts have ended up in Iowa's courts. Most recently, the Iowa Supreme Court upheld a 2019 law that blocked Planned Parenthood from receiving federal funding to provide sex education curriculum in Iowa. In other cases, abortion rights advocates have prevailed. Earlier this year, a district court judge struck down a law that required a 24-hour waiting period for a woman seeking an abortion, ruling the restriction unconstitutional. The Reynolds administration is appealing the ruling. I absolutely don't agree with the decision, and that's what the process is for, Reynolds said last month during a news conference at the Iowa Capitol. Certainly, we'll be appealing that decision, and we're pretty confident that we can get the outcome that we're looking for. Turning to the Iowa Today page and the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. Under the heading In the News, sentencing delayed in Tibbetts case. A judge delayed sentencing for the man convicted of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts after defense lawyers said they needed time to investigate new information pointing to other potential suspects. Christian Bahena Rivera, 27, was scheduled to be sentenced to life in prison without parole Thursday before his lawyers revealed newly obtained information that they say might implicate a sex trafficking ring in her kidnapping and death. Defense lawyers requested a new trial, saying two witnesses recently came forward to partially support Bahena Rivera's testimony. Home test. Test Iowa, the state's free COVID-19 testing program, will transition from testing at drive-through sites to providing access to free, self-administered test kits. Iowans will be able to receive a free kit, collect a saliva sample at home, return the sample by UPS, and receive results through email. Plane crash. Two people died Wednesday after a private airplane they were on crashed in rural Muscatine County. Muscatine County Sheriff Quinn Reese later said the victims were identified as Daniel and Sharon Slack of El Dorado Springs, Missouri. Big reward. Officials with Crime Stoppers of the Cedar Valley announced the reward for information leading to an arrest in the 2012 slayings of cousins Elizabeth Collins and Lyric Cook Morrissey topped $100,000 recently thanks to the help of two anonymous donors. They said, "As a matter of fact, I think she would be a great presidential candidate right now." Bob Vanderplatz, a Christian conservative leader on Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. And we've really had a lot of people check out of the labor force, and we don't know what it's going to take to get them back in. Dave Swenson, Iowa State University economist on Iowa's slowly recovering post-pandemic workforce. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Monopoly Busting, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack in Iowa announced federal plans to launch programs to increase competition in the meat processing industry and resiliency in the food supply chain. Council actions. Members of the Legislative Council approved pay raises of 1.1% to cover cost of living increases similar to those of other state workers for legislative employees. The panel also approved 8 interim study panels. Conditions improve. Drought conditions persist in some parts of Iowa, but substantial rainstorms last weekend took the edge off concerns over developing corn and soybean crops, state officials said. Under the heading The Water Cooler, recruiting women. Linda Upmeyer, the first female speaker of the Iowa House and co-chairwoman of the Republican Party of Iowa, is launching a statewide Build the Bench campaign to recruit Republican women to run for office. Parks App. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources has developed an online mapping application to help visitors navigate trails in state parks by identifying trail names, trailheads, and acceptable trail uses. Roadsite. Information on Iowa's state and U.S. highways and interstates is now on one website, 511ia.org. The new version replaces a variety of formats. And under the heading More in the News, tornadoes hit, no deaths reported. No deaths or injuries were reported from tornadoes that tore through central and eastern Iowa, but many found damaged buildings, shredded trees, and overturned vehicles in the path of the storms, officials said. Law enforcement and trained spotters confirmed several tornadoes Wednesday in mostly rural, uninhabited areas, the National Weather Service said. But one that touched down near Lake City in north-central Iowa damaged a home, flipped a truck and trailer, and flattened nearby corn crops, the Fort Dodge Messenger reported. Nunn running. Republican State Senator Zach Nunn is running for the U.S. House in central Iowa's 3rd District. Republican State Representative Mary Ann Hanusa previously announced her candidacy. The 3rd District is represented by Democratic U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, who has not said whether she will seek a third term. Degere Mulling. Deidre Degere, a Des Moines businesswoman and former candidate for Iowa's top elections office, announced she has formed a committee to explore a run for Iowa governor in 2022. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds is widely expected to seek re-election. And gambling money. Iowa's 19 state-licensed casinos reported for fiscal 2021 adjusted gross revenue topping $3.2 billion. That includes nearly $1.6 billion via their slot machines and table games, and a separate sports wagering handle of over $1.2 billion that netted them nearly $90 million in receipts. Turning to opinions, well, Adam Sullivan's In Iowa column is on the Iowa Today section rather than the Inside section, but here we go. Biden should heed Iowa's lead on licensing requirements. President Joe Biden earlier this month issued a lengthy executive order intended to promote competition in the U.S. economy. The sweeping document covers a range of economic and regulatory issues, including one now highlighted by three presidents in a row, burdensome professional licensing requirements. On that, the Biden administration could take some pointers from Iowa Republicans. A significant portion of American jobs require workers, as much as a quarter of the workforce by some counts, to have special approval from the government. For many years, the trend was to expand licensing requirements to more and more industries. Ostensibly, the occupational licensing system is set up to ensure competency and accountability among workers who might jeopardize consumers' health and safety. But in reality, it's part of a crony scheme that drives up the cost of services and limits employment opportunities, especially for people who already have limited opportunities. There's a strong case for doctors being licensed, but what about florists and hair braiders? Biden's new executive order calls to ban or limit unnecessary, cumbersome occupational licensing requirements that impede economic mobility, according to a White House fact sheet. It's a laudable effort, but the president and his vast federal bureaucracy have limited influence over professional licensing requirements, which are mostly imposed through a patchwork of state laws. To push the issue forward, he'll need buy-in from state legislatures and governors. Iowa offers a model for a bipartisan solution. The economic incentives behind licensing requirements are easy to understand. People who already are established in the industry sometimes erect barriers to stifle their would-be competitors, artificially making their services more scarce and therefore more expensive. Many of those same industry insiders make money or benefit from underpaid labor by providing the training and education license seekers are required to undertake. Scaling back professional licensing is a libertarian policy project that in recent years has been embraced by conservatives and progressives alike. At the presidential level, there has been bipartisan consensus on the issue for about a decade. President Barack Obama in 2015 tried to push the issue onto states' policy agendas. His administration issued a report detailing the cost of occupational licensing and charting a path to reform. It noted that the number of licensed workers had grown by 5 times since the 1950s, mostly caused by bringing new professions into licensing systems. Federal guidance from the Obama era singled out Iowa at the time as having the highest share of licensed workers in the nation, at 33%, and for having extreme training requirements, such as 16 months of education for cosmetologists. President Donald Trump followed up on Obama's recommendations, encouraging states to take up licensing reform, including with a 2020 executive order laying out principles for smart licensing. It encouraged regulations that are the least restrictive to competition, sufficient to protect consumers from significant and demonstrable harm. Iowa answered Obama's and Trump's call to trim and streamline the licensing system. In 2020, the Iowa legislature passed and Governor Kim Reynolds signed a package to modernize what until then was seen as one of the most onerous regulatory state schemes in the nation. Iowa's law directly addressed one of the key problems highlighted by the Obama report, the fact that licensing makes it more difficult to cross state lines to work, a burden that weighs particularly heavy on immigrants and military families. The legislation allows Iowa residents with out-of-state professional licenses to practice in Iowa without jumping through extra regulatory hoops, a policy known as universal licensing or licensing reciprocity, one of the first of its kind in the nation. Iowa's 2020 law also took into account the Trump administration's recommendations, in particular by lowering barriers for people with criminal convictions. To that end, the law limited the instances where a criminal conviction can be grounds for revoking or denying a license. Additionally, Iowa's law allows work experience to substitute for educational requirements in some cases and waives licensing fees for low-income applicants. It was a good bill, expanding Iowa's freedoms and leveling the playing field for newcomers to regulated industries. Encouragingly, it borrowed pieces from Republican and Democratic presidents' playbooks. And now Biden, third in the line of professional licensing reformers in the White House, is raising the issue again. He would be wise to encourage other states to follow Iowa's lead. Todd Dorman's 24-hour Dorman column, Big Bucks, Big Plans for Rescue Act Funds. President Joe Biden is sending Cedar Rapids $28 million as part of the American Rescue Plan. It's a big chunk of change. So naturally, a lot of folks have ideas on how best to spend it in a city not only hit with a pandemic, but also that derecho you might have heard about. City officials have laid out a broad brush plans for how they'd like to spend the money. At a presentation during this past week's city council meeting, staff said the money should be focused on 4 areas. Housing and social services, workforce training and education, west side flood protection, and revenue losses sustained through disasters both viral and stormy. Under housing and social services, the city hopes to seek proposals for housing projects in cooperation with Linn County, which is getting $44 million from the rescue plan. There would be money for the patch program, helping property owners make a still long list of derecho repairs, and the city would seek an expanded permanent home for the west side Ladd Library, which also would serve as an opportunity center providing access to various services. Other dollars would be used to address workforce shortages through education and training programs, partnering with the Pathways Program at Kirkwood Community College and the Small Business Development Center. Using ARP dollars on Westside flood protection, the city argues, addresses the inequity caused by the federal government only funding levees and flood walls on the east side of the river. As for revenue losses, a chunk would go to local nonprofits who saw a plunge in aid from the hotel motel tax. Officials say they gathered input in forming their plans from local groups such as Waypoint that are coordinating recovery services, a community impact survey done in coordination with Linn County and the United Way, and door-to-door conversations with 950 residents. We're a very resource-rich community in many ways, so encouraging those nonprofits to work together and bring the knowledge that they have of their needs is a key component of this, Mayor Brad Hart said during a brief discussion after the presentation. Hart is seeking re-election this fall. Much more to come, Hart said, speaking to the fact that more specific details of the plan will be coming in the next few weeks. So is everyone singing from the city's hymnal? Not exactly. At the same meeting, a trio of groups, the Advocates for Social Justice, the Sunrise Movement, and Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, outlined their own plan for creating a task force aimed at spending $10 million on 250 climate-conscious affordable housing units in Cedar Rapids. Public money should go toward people, said Jamie Izaguirre of Iowa CCI. Supporters carried small signs saying public money for public good. Advocates for Social Justice and the Sunshine Movement pushed the city to address police reforms and adopt a climate action plan, respectively. Now the groups are using their clout to address housing. Mayoral candidate Amara Andrews, a member of the Advocates for Social Justice, supports that plan. I think that is a logical proposal to have a task force to study the issue of homelessness and to put forth a plan to help people out of homelessness makes sense. It's a big problem in our city, Andrews told me this past week. Now is the perfect time when we have the Recovery Act funding. Andrews also has her own plan for spending ARP funds. She would direct dollars to the human welfare infrastructure in Cedar Rapids, namely nonprofits providing critical relief and recovery services. She would make investments in existing small businesses and startups and address workforce shortages. She wants multiple opportunity centers in the city to provide employment resources and address transportation, childcare, training, and other employment barriers. The reality is that we need to help the people in need, and that is certainly what the focus should be. And any plan that doesn't put people first is not paying attention, Andrews said. Andrews believes the city should shoulder more of the burden currently borne by nonprofits. There are still a lot of houses in disrepair and people who are homeless as a result, and the struggle of getting materials and getting people to work on those repairs and navigating insurance claims still is a big problem in the community, Andrews said. I don't want us to lose sight of that. I feel like the city is relying a lot on the nonprofits to deal with some of these issues. Mayoral candidate Tiffany O'Donnell is not a fan of the task force proposal, arguing instead that the city council must take the lead and listen to the needs of residents. They are our elected officials, and by the way, we can hold them accountable, O'Donnell said in an interview, noting that the United Way and other groups are assessing housing needs. I really want to focus on infill housing with a designated portion for affordable housing, housing and affordable housing in areas that were hardest hit by our natural disasters, COVID, and certainly flooding, O'Donnell said. I look a lot at downtown and those surrounding neighborhoods, and they have felt the biggest impacts over the years. Our downtown is hollow today. I'm in and out of businesses that tell me every day they're not bringing all of their people back for the foreseeable future, she said. Downtown housing in Cedar Rapids in recent years has meant lofts and other offerings for higher-income professionals, but O'Donnell contends a better mix is needed to revitalize the core. I think a downtown is a city center. It becomes the signature of any successful town. Certainly the second-largest city in the state needs a hallmark downtown, O'Donnell said. O'Donnell also wants to direct $3 million to nonprofits, including derecho recovery efforts and $5 million to small business recovery. The good news in all of this is none of these ideas are bad ideas. The needs are clear. A lack of affordable housing was a big issue even before the derecho damaged thousands of housing units. Harnessing underskilled workers to fill jobs has been a long-time goal here. Nonprofits, flood protection, a better library with expansive services, all worthy objectives. Cedar Rapids has three mayoral candidates with serious, substantive policy proposals. A good sign. The city and county working together? A sign of the apocalypse? Nah, we already lived through that. Now we'll see how the details unfold. And from Gazette editorial fellow Sophia DiMartino, school-to-prison pipeline is no myth. Last month, the Department of Human Rights released data that showed racial disparities in the Iowa criminal justice system extend to children in the Cedar Rapids Community School District. This information seems less than surprising. Iowa is already known to suffer some of the worst racial disparities in the country. Introducing an arm of this institution into public schools and expecting a different result is nonsensical. People in institutions carry their implicit biases with them wherever they go. When the in-school disparities came to light, the Cedar Rapids Police Department reacted by describing the school-to-prison pipeline as a myth, a fragility response that was both tragically unhelpful and woefully predictable. Having taken my own trip from sophomore year to juvenile incarceration, I have no intention of attempting to prove the existence of the pipeline to those who refuse to acknowledge it, because to do so disrupts their own self-image. Instead, I got in touch with some of the people working tirelessly to create pathways to success for our youth, despite the systemic barriers that threaten to render them a statistic. Cedar Rapids' oldest nonprofit, Tanager Place, provides a variety of support and empowerment services, including on-site therapy in over 35 schools, a scholarship program, and the only LGBTQ youth center in our community. CEO Opara Rice said of their work, "We are having much more deliberate conversations about the school-to-prison pipeline. We are looking at the needs of our youth related to absenteeism, behavior, training for teachers. This is about a deeper relationship than just providing services. We must have a treatment mindset, but more alignment with our clients holistically." Rice touched on the current efforts by the district to address the disparities in school resource officer engagement. "There is a lot of work yet to be done, but people are coming to the table differently and having conversations about what we can improve on. This sentiment was echoed by Al O'Bannon, founder of Leaders, Believers, Achievers. LBA's programs are divided into two categories, Healthy Lifestyles and CR Dreams, a leadership development program. We focus on prevention and inspiring hope, a sense of value and belonging outside of the world that they have been seeing. This work begins at LBA with the creation of personal goals and purpose statements and is supported by a team of people working to help students achieve them. They create their own goals. We want them to be accountable for their own starting place. The Central City Development Corporation is an organization working to provide restorative justice and restorative practices training in the Cedar Rapids area. Director of Program Delivery and Transformation, Dr. Kathleen Bevins, described current efforts. Our current local efforts are primarily focused on restorative practices and gun violence prevention, as well as working with the Violence Intervention Initiatives with the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation. We are in the middle of a deep dive restorative justice series, and our next session will be focused on systems and schools. Bevins acknowledges that there is work to be done in generating community support. We need to build community capacity. If we want this in our school district and judicial system, then people have to understand what it is and feel comfortable with it first in order to see the value. In 2020, Bevins worked with Central City Development Corporation in Reset 2020 on the Youth and Family Challenge. This initiative was one of many projects supported by the Creating Safe, Equitable, and Thriving, or SET, Communities Fund housed at the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation. I asked Program Officer Rachel Rockwell about the role of SET in disrupting the school-to-prison pipeline. I would say that it is an explicit goal of SET and the group violence intervention model. The purpose of the program is to keep young people safe, alive, and out of prison. These are truly only a few of the many resources and individuals working to create positive change for youth in our community. It is also important to state that while these efforts are critical to creating tangible outcomes, the pipeline itself cannot be dismantled by addressing the youth in question as if they are somehow to blame or as if you could cure the illness by treating some of the symptoms and never addressing the root cause. When it comes to those disparities, the youth are not the problem. I say again, the youth are not the problem. It is incumbent upon us the community, us the collective, us the village, to support the success of our children as best we are able. Please find links for donations to the programs mentioned above here. The RFP for 2021 SET funding opened July 15th. Details may be found at the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation website. Turning to the community letters and today's editorial cartoon from cartoonist Joe Heller of Green Bay. Man and a woman are sitting on the couch. She's looking at the TV where there's an announcement, Olympic athletes won't have audience. And she says, imagine after years of toil, no one will be there to cheer for them in the end. And the man is reading the newspaper with the headline, U.S. leaving Afghanistan, with a drawing of the Taliban cheering, and the man says, it could be worse. The first letter is from Mary Gravett of Iowa City. Class action lawsuit could silence fireworks. The people of Iowa need to bring a class action suit against former Governor Terry Branstad and Governor Kim Reynolds for creating the nuisance law of allowing the sale of fireworks to civilians in the state. Hospital statistics in Iowa City and Des Moines prove that injuries have increased since the passage of the firecracker law under the Branstad administration, of which Reynolds was the lieutenant governor. The 4th of July season is the beginning of a summer of hell as the population lives in a simulated war zone, with firecrackers exploding night and day without abatement. Humans and animals must live with high decibel sounds and lack of sleep so that the state of Iowa can make 6% off the sale of fireworks, while a population that is most high off substance must endure. A class action lawsuit is the only answer to forcing the repeal of the firecracker sales law. And if this does not work, the election of 22 should have some influence. We, the people of Iowa, hold the power because we have the vote. Mary Gravett of Iowa City. Next, Rob Sandquist of Cedar Rapids writes, loss of local printing jobs is sad to see. Why in the world would the Gazette want to have an out-of-town company print the newspaper? It's sad to see. The Gazette is a locally owned newspaper. Shame on you. Just wait until winter. The Gazette had numerous late deliveries because of winter weather last year. What do you think is going to happen here? It's going to make it even worse. I see your subscribers not getting a paper, period, until the next day. When my subscription to the Gazette expires, I will not be renewing because of your decision to move printing out of the local area. Rob Sandquist of Cedar Rapids. Next, Rebecca Burgess of Iowa City writes, Congress must act to end endless wars. Nearly 20 years ago, fearing that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that he would use against the U.S. and his own people, our Congress passed the 2002 Authorization for Use of Military Force, or AUMF, giving permission to our military to use force against his regime. The Saddam Hussein regime was overthrown in 2003, and the U.S. mission in Iraq was formally declared over in 2011. Yet this law still exists and is open to abuse. In 2020, it was misused to justify the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. I am pleased that Senator Chuck Grassley is a co-sponsor of Senate Joint Resolution 10, which would repeal this outdated law, and I hope Senator Joni Ernst will join him in a vote yes. Repealing the AUMF is a critical step in reasserting Congress's constitutional duty to determine when the United States goes to war. Rebecca Burgess of Iowa City. Next, Anthony Robinson of Iowa City writes, Reclaim Congress's role in use of military force. Our country's founders understood the importance of separating the powers of our government's three branches. Hence, our Constitution placed the power to introduce U.S. armed forces into hostilities in the hands of Congress rather than the president, except for propelling an attack. The 2001 and 2002 AUMFs, authorizations for use of military force, were passed to allow the Bush administration to fight al-Qaeda and the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq. By now, the AUMFs have been used by three presidents acting without congressional approval to justify 41 operations in 19 countries, and most of these operations fall outside the original intent of the AUMFs. Congress is long overdue in reclaiming its constitutional right to say when we wage war. The House took a major step in this direction by passing a bill to repeal the 2002 AUMF on June 17th. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley has co-sponsored a bipartisan companion bill in the Senate, SJ Resolution 10, to do the same. We hope that Senator Joni Ernst will likewise reclaim her constitutional power by publicly supporting SJ Resolution 10. Anthony Robinson of Iowa City. And the final letter is from Otto Klassen of Van Horn. Troopers would have been helpful on January 6th. Maybe Governor Reynolds should have sent the state patrol troopers to the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. That was a crisis. Instead of sending them down to Mexican border in July, we could have used them here. Otto Klassen of Van Horn. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 18th, 2021, on the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Network. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and we turn to the obituaries for today. Stephen Donald Zimmerman, 56, of Anamosa, passed away on Monday, July 5th in Kamakura, Japan, after falling ill while on assignment. A celebration of life will take place on Saturday, July 31st, from noon to 3 p.m. at the American Legion Hall, 300 Chamber Court in Anamosa. A private interment with military honors will take place at Norwich Cemetery with the assistance of Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home and the Anamosa American Legion. Stephen retired from the Navy in 2004. He then joined the military Sealift Command and continued his culinary career, taking many courses and earning certifications to become a steward cook, most recently above the USNS Carl Brashear. He served on many vessels, from tugboats to aircraft carriers, on which as galley supervisor he organized thousands of meals per day and always made sure the enlisted were fed wonderful holiday spreads. Deborah Eileen Brown, 69, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, May 10, 2020, following a short illness. An open house for friends and family to share will be held from 3:30 to 5:30 p.m. Saturday, August 21st, at the Cedar Memorial Family Center and Library. Patricia Powers Burke, 86, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Marion, passed away on December 14, 2020, at Arbor Place within Methwick Community. A memorial mass will be held for family and friends at 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 23rd, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Marion, with Father David O'Connor officiating. Jeffrey Allen Freund, from July 10, 1950 to November 24, 2020. A celebration of life will be held today, Sunday, July 18th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Loyal Order of Moose Lodges, 1820 Westport Road in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Please come and share with family and friends your memories, stories, and your experiences with this exceptional man who left us too soon after courageously facing cancer for 16 months. Mary L. Cochran of Cedar Rapids was a sweet, instantly lovable, and upbeat mother, grandmother, great, and great-great-grandmother, who passed away peacefully surrounded by loved ones at the age of 101. All that knew Mary were well aware she was a woman of simple pleasures and whose youthful exuberance later in life often led others to be astonished at her true age. Word quickly spread on how dangerous it could be to get between Mary and her daily breakfast of an English muffin with piping hot black coffee. A visitation and funeral service is scheduled from 10 a.m. to noon on July 21st at Cedar Memorial in Cedar Rapids. Robert Ford, known as Bob, passed away Sunday, March 29, 2020, at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital. A funeral mass will be held Friday, July 23rd at 10 a.m. at St. Pius X Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, followed by the family greeting. Cecilia L. Gurwood, 86, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Monday, July 12th. A visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. Monday, July 19th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. A memorial service and burial will take place immediately following. Cecilia enjoyed shopping, gardening, cooking, getting together with family, attending concerts, and dancing. She especially loved animals, including her three cockatiels, Joey, Angel, and Derecho, and her outdoor kitties. The family is having a celebration of life for James Mayberry, who lived from July 1944 until August 11, 2020. The celebration of life will be from 2 to 5 p.m. July 18th, that's today, at the Eagles Club in Cedar Rapids. Arthur Nefsker, known as Art, age 82, of Earlville, passed away at his home on Tuesday, November 24th, 2020. Graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, July 24th at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery, Earlville, with Reverend Dennis Quint officiating. A celebration will follow burial at Conrad Park, East 3rd Street, Earlville, Iowa. Vicki Sue Hadley, 60, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died Friday, July 9th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Vicki worked as a professional bartender at various taverns such as Bully's, Mr. B's, and O'Maggie's Pub. Vicki was an incredible baker and cook, a devoted mother, and one of the most beautiful persons both inside and out to ever walk the planet. She was a continual supplier of cookies, candies, and pies to the neighbors. She will be dearly missed by all that knew her. Chandler Topic Evans, 56, of Ankeny, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died peacefully surrounded by his family on Tuesday, July 13th, of kidney and liver failure. A memorial service will take place at 3 p.m. Friday, July 30th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will take place at 3 p.m. Saturday, July 31st, at the Ankeny Bandshell, 410 West 1st Street in Ankeny. Chandler started his sales career at Nevada Bob's, then worked for Mizuno Golf. He finished his golf career with Nike Golf and Apparel. After his sales career, he decided to pursue his dream of opening the Wheelhouse Pizza and Pub. This was his passion and his dream that he opened in Ankeny in 2013. When he opened the Wheelhouse every Christmas and Thanksgiving, he would open the restaurant for guests who didn't have a place to go. His patrons and employees at Wheelhouse were his second family. Jason Everett O'Connor, known as Redneck, age 44, of Cedar Rapids, passed away at 5:15 p.m. on Thursday, July 15th at St. Luke's Hospital. Celebration of Life Gathering will be from 3 to 8 p.m. Friday, July 23rd at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street, Southwest. Jason's last ride will begin at 2 p.m. July 24th from Brosh Chapel and will travel to North Point Bar, located at 621 Center Point Road Northeast, where his celebration of life will begin at 3 p.m. on Saturday. Jason worked at Whirlpool for nearly 15 years and was currently working at Van Meter Company. He enjoyed camping, riding his Harley, socializing with his many friends, and most of all, spending time with his family, especially his kids. Ashley Rainville, known as Big Mama, age 37, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Wednesday, July 14th from a sudden illness. Ashley enjoyed colored pencil drawings, coloring mandalas, music, watching G.I. Joe, and talking on the phone with her friends. Richard Edmund Krogh, age 90, known as Dick, of Central City, passed away on Friday, July 9th at St. Luke's Transitional Care Center in Cedar Rapids. In agreement with his wishes, cremation has taken place. A memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 31st at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, located at 915 27th Street in Marion, where the family will greet friends for 1 hour prior to the service. Military honors will follow the service. A private interment will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Dick was born to be a farmer and had a passion for raising cattle. He farmed together with his brother Warren in the Central City area for 62 years. Dick was a member of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Marion. He had an infectious sense of humor. Dick was a loyal Iowa Hawkeyes fan and enjoyed watching all college football games. Gary Edward Fabian of Iowa City. Gary left us way too early on July 6th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Always a happy person and a great CPA, Gary worked for Greenwood and Krim and Winkle, Parker and Foster until his retirement. He had an incredible memory for details, and you didn't want to get into a memory match with him as Gary would beat you every time. A celebration of life service will be held at 10 a.m. August 14th at First Lutheran Church, 1000 3rd Avenue Southeast, Cedar Rapids. On July 1st, 2020, Herbert Otis Hoover ended his journey gently and with dignity in the presence of his family in the home that he built. A celebration of life honoring Herbert will be held from 10 a.m. to noon, Friday, July 23rd at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Diane Phelan, born Diane Simoff, 65, of Fairfax, peacefully passed away on December 16, 2020, after a courageous four-year battle with cancer. She was a true warrior and a force to be reckoned with. She took on the challenges with grace and resolve. Diane was the most selfless, devoted, and loving mother to her daughters. In later years, Jamie and Laura considered her their best friend. Diane loved her friends and spent her time enjoying motorcycle rides, traveling, cards, antique shopping, beach vacations to Mexico with Patrick and friends, and spending time with her grandkids. Diane was a lover of cats, gardening, cooking, baking, reading, crosswords, and puzzles. An open house style celebration of life party will be held from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. July 25th at Wannady Park's Prairie Oak Lodge, formerly known as Squaw Creek. Food and greetings will begin at 11 a.m. with live music beginning at 1 p.m. Raymond William Randall, 88, of LaPorte City, Iowa, died Thursday, July 1st at home in his sleep. A funeral service will take place 2 p.m. Sunday, July 25th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Burial, Linwood Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. In Raymond's years of retirement, he enjoyed spending time with his wife and the rest of the family. Raymond enjoyed woodworking as well as watching wrestling and westerns on the television in his spare time. Stephanie Ann DeShaw, 37, of North Liberty, passed away unexpectedly July 12th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. A private visitation will take place to say their final goodbyes to their beloved daughter, wife, mother, sister, and aunt. However, a memorial service for friends and family will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, July 20th at Life Church, 2205 2nd Street, Coralville. Private burial will be at Ridgewood Cemetery in North Liberty. Betty Gruel, 95, of Marion, passed away on July 10th at Northbrook Manor Care Center. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, July 20th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, with funeral service to follow starting at 11 a.m. Betty worked as a home daycare provider and later as a school bus attendant for Linmar Schools. Betty loved to cook, flowers, and spending time with her family. James Allen Kavensky, 49, of Marion, Iowa, passed away on July 15th at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. There will be no visitation because of COVID-19. There will be a chapel service at 1 p.m. Tuesday, July 20th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Jim was a manager of Coastal Mart for 10 years and worked for Roto-Rooter for 10 years. He was affiliated with Squaw Creek Baptist Church in Marion. He enjoyed fishing and hunting. He loved life and helping others. Lorraine Jaster, age 70, of Newhall, passed away Monday, July 12th at St. Luke's Hospital. No services are planned at this time. Lorraine loved flower arranging, sold Tupperware for many years, and spent most of her years successfully raising 5 children. Max Eugene Brown, age 81, of Story City, formerly of Marion, died July 12th at Bethany Life Community. A visitation will be 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 24th at Grandin Funeral and Cremation Care, 414 Lincoln Way, Ames. The funeral service for Max will start at 10:30 a.m. at Grandin Funeral and Cremation Care. Burial will take place at 3 p.m. Saturday, July 24th at Oakshade Cemetery in Marion. Lonnie Dean Clark, 57, of Waterloo, died Monday, July 12th. Funeral services will be 1 p.m. Saturday, July 24th at the First Christian Church. Visitation 1 hour prior to services, Lynn's Funeral Home, Iowa Falls. Delaney J. Meal, age 30, known as DJ, of Robbins, died March 19th, 2020. Due to the pandemic, funeral services were not held immediately. A memorial service will now be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, July 24th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, interment with military rites in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. DJ was a semi-truck driver for most of his adult life. He was a proud member of the Iowa National Guard, stationed in Cedar Rapids. He enjoyed his dogs, Volkswagens, and playing Xbox with his brothers and friends. He loved buying, building, and trading guns, as well as target shooting with his wife, Tori. H. Philip Snitke and Jason Philip Snitke. H. Philip Phil Snitke, age 73, of Clive, Iowa, formerly of Walker, passed away on Thursday, October 15, 2020, at Unity Point Health Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. 4 months and 5 days later, one of his sons, Jason Philip Snitke, 50, also of Clive and formerly of Walker, passed away on Saturday, February 20, 2021, following a sudden illness at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Please join the Snitke family in celebrating the lives of Phil Pops and Jason J. as we eat, drink, and be Irish in their honor. Bring your stories and memories to remember and honor them while having a good time, which is what they had asked for and wanted. An Irish wake for both Phil and Jason will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Saturday, July 24th at Walker City Park North Pavilion, located at 306 Park Street in Walker. Feel free to come and go as you please. Food will be served beginning at 4 p.m., and a limited selection of beverages will be available. Please dress casual. B.O.B. if you would like, just make sure you bring it in a cooler. The Reverend Dr. David Franz Larson of Eugene, Oregon, died on June 29th. He was 93 years old. David served as a pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America for 40 years in Austin, Texas, Littleton, Colorado, St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids, Billings, Montana, Portland, Oregon, and Torrance, California. After his retirement, he served as an interim pastor in both Novato and Napa, California. Pastor Larson will be interred at the Memorial Courtyard at Central Lutheran Church in Eugene. Memorial service is planned for 1 p.m. August 7th at MAS Lutheran Church in Eugene, Oregon. Catherine Larson, 91, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Tuesday, July 13th at The Grove, St. Charles, Illinois. Services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, July 24th at Cedar Memorial Funeral Home. Visitation will be 10 to 11 a.m. prior to the service. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Catherine married Rayford Lawson in Lisbon on April 16th, 1950. They were members of First United Methodist Church in Marion. Catherine would be greatly missed by those who knew and loved her. Turning to sports, Mike Loss writes, Will Gilman be Iowa's big 2021 Olympic story? Former Hawkeye goes for Olympic gold in Tokyo. Consider this a potluck. Take what you want, leave what you don't, and don't forget to take your Tupperware home. The Olympics start this week. Let's beat Russia. I just thought I would go on record, Yankee Doodle Dandy and all that jazz. Zavur Yugyev of Russia is the number 2 seed at 57 kilograms in men's freestyle wrestling. He's a 2-time world champion. Thomas Gilman, via Council Bluffs and the University of Iowa, isn't among the top 4 seeds in that loaded weight class. Gilman has been a model of perseverance since his Hawkeye career ended in 2017. If he were to leave Tokyo with a gold medal, it would be one of the greatest wrestling stories any Iowan has written, and that's saying something. As per the rest of the Olympics, they've added surfing, skateboarding, and sport climbing this year. Finally, the games have the sports to which I've devoted my life. COVID-19. Yeah, that again. If the Delta variant accelerates and shuts down my vacation plans next month, I'll be looking for someone to blame, so the whole planet is officially on notice. How forgiving would you be if COVID-19 cost your college football team and lost instead of a no contest? Frankly, I'm exhausted, Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlesby said last week about COVID-19's impact on athletics. I wasn't excited about revisiting protocols for this fall, and yet I think if you're honest with oneself, you have to. You have to look at it and say, yeah, we wish we were done with it, but we're probably not quite done with it. We're probably not going to have the ability to not play games this season, Kansas State Athletics Director Gene Taylor said. If you don't play it on time, you'll have to forfeit. We haven't finalized that yet as a league, but that is where we're thinking as athletic directors. We don't have room. Last year, we had breaks in our schedule on purpose. This year, we won't have the ability to make up those games. Imagine the wrath that we'd be headed players' way if enough of them tested positive for COVID-19 to cause a forfeit and they were unvaccinated. How much wrath, however, could be legitimately summoned by fans in states in which less than half the entire population were fully vaccinated? As of last Thursday, that was 48.9% in Iowa. That's not close to great, but it's the runaway leader of the 5 Big 12 states. Second best was Kansas at 42.8%, followed by Texas at 42.3%, Oklahoma at 39.3%, and West Virginia at 38.8%. In the Big Ten, the two leaders were Maryland at 57.5% and New Jersey at 56.7%. Maybe that's why the conference added Maryland and Rutgers. Minnesota was at 52.9%, Pennsylvania at 51.0%, Wisconsin at 50.9%, Nebraska at 48.5%, Michigan at 48.1%, Illinois at 47.4%, Ohio at 45.6%, and Indiana at 43.3%. The national rate was 48.4% and 56.6% for those at least 12 years old. Speaking of college football, here are my preseason picks to win 4 of the 5 major conferences. Big Ten, Ohio State. Big 12, Oklahoma. ACC, Clemson. SEC, Alabama. That came after a lot of careful consideration. And the college basketball transfer portal is quite a place. Saturday, senior-to-be guard Marcus Carr announced he was transferring from Minnesota to Texas. Carr averaged 19.4 points and 4.9 assists per game last season. He joins Massachusetts transfer Trey Mitchell, 18.8 games per last season, Utah transfer Timmy Allen, 17.2, Vanderbilt transfer Dylan Disu, 15.0, and Creighton transfer Christian Bishop, 11.0. Mark Texas down as the Big 12's preseason favorite for 21-22. The Big Ten's apparent favorite, however, has added 0 transfers. That's Purdue, which could be great. The Boilermakers return a lot of terrific players, including a guard who may become a candidate for National Player of the Year, sophomore Jaden Ivey. Plus, Purdue added the top 2 players in the 2021 Indiana Mr. Basketball voting. Matt Painter is trying to make his team great through recruiting and retention. It's an interesting concept that will probably never catch on. And some brief notes from the sideline section. In college football, the Cyclones add 4-star receiver to class. Iowa State got its second 4-star commitment for 2022 Saturday when receiver Greg Gaines gave his pledge. The 6'2" receiver had offers from Auburn, Georgia, Florida State, and Penn State, among many others. Gaines, from Tampa, Florida, is ranked as the number 4 receiver nationally by 247 Sports. In college baseball, Kirkwood catcher set to join Hawkeyes. Kirkwood freshman Cade Moss announced on social media he was joining the Iowa Hawkeyes to continue to play baseball. The catcher from Johnston hit .349 with 4 doubles and 3 home runs this spring with the Eagles. And in college golf, future Hawkeye reaches semifinals in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Iowa incoming freshman women's golfer Paula Miranda reached the semifinals of the 72nd U.S. Junior Championships before falling to eventual champion Rose Zhang on Friday at Columbia Country Club. Miranda, the number 44 ranked amateur in the world, defeated 4 golfers in match play before losing to Zhang on Friday after 20 holes. From Iowa Today, Anamosa shifts into high gear for RAGBRAI. Big Grant Wood-inspired statue will greet riders by Riley Wilson of the Gazette. Bike riders and visitors stopping in Anamosa on this year's RAGBRAI will be greeted by a larger-than-life piece of the town's history. God Bless America, a 25-foot, 32,000-pound sculpture by artist Seward Johnson depicting figures from Grant Wood's American Gothic painting will be in town for the event. The Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa was canceled last year because of the pandemic, but this year's ride is back on, starting July 25th in Northwest Iowa's Lamar's. On July 29th, the estimated 20,000 riders will come as close to the corridor as this year's route takes them as they make their way from the overnight cities of Waterloo to Anamosa. The trek is 84.7 miles, the longest day of the week-long ride. Leanna Boone, director of the Anamosa Chamber of Commerce, said the focus for the event this year is to keep the events and entertainment local. "We're trying to do everything in town to benefit our residents and our businesses," she said. Boone said the extra year planning allowed for the RAGBRAI committee to bring the God Bless America sculpture back to town. RAGBRAI gives host towns $15,000 toward a nonprofit organization, which Anamosa used to acquire the artwork following the event. For the event, "We felt that it was very important to Anamosa that we had it here," Boone said. "We had it here in 2018. It was a huge boost for tourism in town. Our businesses greatly benefited from having the sculpture in town." Boone hopes the statue can reside permanently in Anamosa, the birthplace of Grant Wood and home to the Grant Wood Art Gallery. The sculpture has been hosted at locations around the country, recently in Saginaw, Michigan and Peoria, Illinois, according to the Seward Johnson Atelier. It is valued at $880,000. Boone said profits from RAGBRAI will go toward acquiring the sculpture permanently. Anamosa last hosted RAGBRAI in 2012, and this year will mark the fourth time the ride has stopped in the town. The 2021 bike ride kept all of the planned stops from the canceled 2020 ride. Cyclists had the option of transferring their registration to 2021 or requesting a refund. Boone said Anamosa was able to keep most of the plans it made for hosting the event before its cancellation in 2020. "The last month is probably the most hectic time, turning all the last-minute details, your final street closures, getting your volunteers lined up, making sure you have all your signs made. It's a lot of little things that all have to come together," she said. After a year of difficult times brought on by the pandemic, local businesses are grateful for the influx of roadway riders headed to town. Dwayne Mosser, manager of Giggle Juice Liquor Station, is gearing up for the event by ordering extra inventory. He expects to sell huge quantities of ice and cold beer, but he said it can be difficult to obtain enough stock and enough employees to cover the day. "Hopefully we can juggle those two things and make as many people happy as we possibly can," he said. Mosser said just about every business in Anamosa is expecting huge sales. "I think you'd be hard-pressed not to notice a bump in your business," he said. Mary Oldham, owner of Grounds and Goodies Coffee Shop in Anamosa, said this is her first RAGBRAI as a business owner and she's not sure exactly what to expect. "We have Pumpkin Fest for the first weekend in October and I keep telling my employees to expect that, maybe times 200, she said. "That's what we're expecting because we're the only coffee shop in town. We're right on Main Street in the middle of everything. And if it's hot out, they're going to come inside because it's air conditioned." Oldham, a member of the vendor committee, said business from riders is hugely important for the town of about 5,500. "This town needs it. Every business in this town needs it after the last year and a half," she said. "So we're looking forward to that and making everyone that comes into town comfortable and welcome and that they have a positive image of Anamosa." And finally, Iowa Profile, UI in New Territory with Key Hire for Theater by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. When the pandemic hit last spring, Caroline Stephanie Clay was living in Los Angeles as an actress and had just wrapped up work on an episode of Shameless, a TV series starring William H. Macy. Like many in her field, Clay was between gigs and auditioning for roles when a shelter-in-place order came down March 19th in her state. "I'm an actress, a working actress," she told the Gazette, describing the shock of watching her profession evaporate overnight. But it gave Clay, who returned to her East Coast roots during the pandemic, the impetus to consider an adventure in the heartland. "It was like, okay, it's time for me to get serious and start looking at alternatives within the arts and within what I love to do and am good at," she said, "and not to toot my own horn, but I'm a hell of a teacher." So when a friend alerted her to the University of Iowa's search for a new lead acting professor atop its Master of Fine Arts program in the Department of Theater Arts, Clay applied. "I had competition," she said. "I had to interview several times. I had to come down and teach a class. I had to meet with panels, the Board of Regents and the dean and chair there." Although Clay has made a name in Tony Award-winning productions on Broadway and in television shows such as Grey's Anatomy, Law & Order SVU, House of Cards, and Shameless, she also has taught acting and instructed voice lessons at intensives at Georgetown, Howard, Bowie State, and Duke Universities, and the University of Maryland. In those academic roles, she follows her family's footsteps. "I come from teachers," Clay said. "My mother was an English teacher. I come from a long, long line of guidance counselors and educators, usually the first African Americans in their school district." In that way, Clay also is following suit with her new UI gig. When interviewing, Clay was told, "Should you get the position, you would be the first African-American female, woman of color, to have a full-time tenure-track position within the 70-year history of the department." That actually gave Clay some pause. "But then there was a part of me that was like, well, you got to start somewhere," she said. "There are a lot of institutions where there's shame around their lack of diversity. Well, the energy that's being used to be ashamed, couldn't that energy be used to diversify?" So she praised UI for recognizing its shortcomings and doing something about it. The storied UI Department of Theater Arts, among the oldest and most revered in the nation, acknowledged. Clay said, "We need new blood. We need new ideas. We need to blow a huge blast of new oxygen into the place," she recalled. "And we think you're the one. We think you are the one. And I was flattered. I also love a challenge." Aside from a 2007 trip to Des Moines for her role in the national tour of the award-winning Broadway show Doubt, Clay had never been to Iowa before recently interviewing for the position as lead acting professor. "Talk about a fish out of water," she said. "This is so different than anything I've ever done." Clay was born in 1968 in Boston and moved with her family in the 1970s to the Washington, D.C. area. At 16, she got into D.C.'s Duke Ellington School for the Performing and Visual Arts and later earned a bachelor's degree from Philadelphia's University of the Arts. She got a Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Maryland years after forging her acting career on the stage and the screen. For her pre-pandemic portrayal of Faye in Geffen Playhouse's production of Dominique Morisseau's Skeleton Crew, Clay recently received the NAACP 2020 Award for Best Actress in a Play. And she's been in one film and one play as the pandemic fades, both with full COVID-19 protocols. Although Clay plans to keep acting even while teaching at Iowa, she noted, "I suspect it will be quite a while before I feel fully comfortable, if ever." When Clay announced her next career move, which she's set to begin on the UI campus in August, some friends raised an eyebrow about her transplanting to the Midwest. But Clay rebuffed them, calling Iowa City an oasis of sorts. "Iowa City in particular I found to be quite diverse," she said. "When I came down for an in-person visit, I saw all these Black Lives Matter flags and businesses. And I saw there was cultural diversity, there were people of color. Had I not seen that, I don't know that this would have been a choice that I would have made." Clay said that the 12-student cohort she's leading is predominantly minority. "If you have students coming to a place that is not as diverse just because of the landscape, I cannot overstate the importance of students seeing themselves reflected in the faculty," she said, "whether it's culturally, whether it's ethnically, whether it's experience-wise." The UI's eye for growth in the industry's forced evolution, Clay said she's excited to both impart her experiential wisdom on the up-and-coming thespians, while also learning with them nuances of the shifting arts and entertainment landscape. "I've got technique up the wazoo. I know the theoretical part," Clay said, "but what I wish there had always been in the business of show business. This is called show business for a reason. It's not called show fun." Clay plans to help students understand agents, marketing, and unionizing, among other things. But she acknowledged some of what her experience has taught her involves humility. "So much of my teaching positions, the power of inquiry and interrogation at its center," she said. "I don't claim to know all of the answers. Actually, I don't claim to know any of them. What I do bring is the spirit of the teacher as a co-learner. I am on the same journey that my students are, only my testimony is informed by my wisdom and experience." And that brings us to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 18th, 2021. I've been your reader, Sharon Falduto. Remember, you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS readings at our website, www.iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.